Best-selling writer Mark Helprin's latest novel, In Sunlight and in Shadow, is set in 1940s New York and encompasses the worlds of theater, industry, high finance, and organized crime, with the ravages of World War II as a backdrop to the action. It's being described as an epic novel. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Helprin back to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
You've called this novel a love song for your family. So is this the most autobiographical of all of your books?
No, of course, the first novel was, and you never know that. You think it's not, and you're shocked when the critics say it's an autobiography. You say, me? I didn't do it. But then later,
I made it all up.
Yeah, when you're on Medicare, you look at it, you read it, and you say, oh, my God, how could I have written that? Because it's all about my life. This one is, that phrase, love song for my family, comes from this. Norman McLean I have a letter that was written by Norman McLean to a producer who wanted to buy the rights to A River Runs Through It. And the producer is one of those bottom feeders in Hollywood who has a company called, you know, Monumental Studios, Apartment Basement 1, La Cienega Boulevard. And they say, we'll give you $100 option and $5,000 if we purchase it to make it a movie. And this is the Ken Kesey trick. You know, then the writer, who doesn't know, sells them that, they flip it to a real movie studio if the book is good. So someone like that, or perhaps more of a top feeder, wrote to Norman McLean. And he said, I want to buy these rights for $100. And Norman McLean wrote the letter, which I have. And in the letter, Norman McLean said two things. He said, I wrote this book as a love song to my family. It's the book that ends, I am haunted by waters. Yeah. And he said, I waited until I was an old man so I could get the tone just right. And that's what I did with this book. It is a love song to my family. It's 80% true, although lots of poetic license, rearranging and protection of the innocent and guilty is the watchword. But I did wait until I could get the right tone. I was old enough.
Well, Harry Copeland is based on your father to some degree, isn't he?
To a large degree, yes.
He was involved in intelligence during the war, and he came back Jewish. Was he a Harvard man as well?
My father, no, but I am.
You are. Yeah. So you merged the two. Yeah. The protagonist in Winter's Tale was Irish, and a soldier in the Great War. He was Italian. So in a sense, this is more personal.
It's much more personal. And it's about the period after the war, which, by the way, I think was elongated into the 50s. Why? Because after the war, we didn't build much. We built Quonset huts for returning veterans. There was a housing shortage. So the commercial areas of cities didn't look different in the very early 50s, till about 52 or 53. Also, politically, Truman was an extension of the Roosevelt years. And, you know, the cars didn't look that much different, et cetera. Fashions, too, a little different. But those are the years that I remember from the middle 40s into the early 50s.
And they were before the Eisenhower did his major highway, built his highway system.
Yeah.
The suburbs suddenly became much more important. The cities were still where you went if you wanted to succeed. And it was also a boom time.
It was a boom time, particularly emotionally. For example, I mean, we had won the war and we were safe, at least until the Soviets got the nuclear weapons. But we felt safe. We felt kind of scared because we had been spared. Europe had not. And that's, by the way, my theory is that we had all those flying saucer movies, invasion, because we were kind of shaking because we had been missed. Mm-hmm. Say during the war, but
until the World Trade Towers, in fact.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that actually the nuclear thing made everyone feel somewhat vulnerable. But we really, it was a time it was the hinge of the century, and we were gliding. See, and those are the years that I remember in tremendous, tremendous detail. Because when I was young, I was like a sponge, and emotionally, what I attempted to do here was to portray what that time was like.
And you include a lot of details from that time. The shops, Woolworths and
Schraffs,
automats, the old Penn Station, yeah, musical theaters, old money estates. Mm-hmm. Did that involve a lot of research? Your mother was an actress, but yeah. not as. But I believe you say she was quite poor. This woman, Catherine Hale here, comes out of that, real money.
That's right. My mother was so poor that when she was in grade school, her family, which had eight children, and the father was a musician who went blind, couldn't feed their children, so she was given over to an Englishman who had a child Shakespeare company and who abused the children. My mother, in a very Dickensian way, went into learning about sex, you know, abusive sex, and training to be a Shakespearean actress. She was as poor as a church mouse, worse, practically a slave. But the reason that Catherine is different is because I had to fall in love with Catherine to write the book, and you can't fall in love with your mother. So mm-hmm. Catherine is not particularly based on my mother.
Although she is abused sexually at the age of 13.
She is, and there's that.
You've written that this book is about the rise of immigrants in 1940s New York and the predominantly generous reception mm-hmm. by the declining Episcopalian aristocracy of the time. But hadn't there been resistance to increasing immigration quotas in the lead-up to the war by aristocrats in the Roosevelt administration like Cordell Hull?
Yes, and in fact, during the Holocaust, the immigration was shut down when it was most needed. But afterwards, it was different.
Although here, a friend of Catherine's parents make virulent anti-Semitic remarks, and, mm-hmm. and Catherine's father remarks on the ways that Catherine and Harry's lives together would be constricted if they married.
And they would have been, to begin with. It's true. But you see, I've had experience of that myself. I mean, I've just as an example, when my parents and I were in Florida in 1954, my father saw a hotel in Boca Raton, this beautiful hotel in a palm grove, and he said, "We'll stay there." And we drove up, and we saw a sign that said, "No Negroes, dogs, or Jews." See, or I mean,
which you've included in this book.
Yeah, I have included it in the book. And I was in hitchhiking when I was a sophomore or junior in college, and I was picked up in a Volkswagen bus. It wasn't a bus, it was a van, by a boy and his very attractive sister. And something went on with the sister and me, and they said, "You want to come to our house for dinner?" It was Darien, Connecticut. Everything was going swimmingly till the father found out that I was a Jew and stood up and said, "Get out of my house," literally threw me out of the house just because of that. So I've experienced that, but I don't believe, I've been beaten many times, refusing to attend church services, compulsory church services in camp. That's not what America is. That was an aberration, and it vanished.
You do include a lot of stuff in this book. For example, there's the mafia. Mm-hmm. First the Jewish mafia, then the Italian mafia. Were you trying to throw in as many different things about how America changed from the end of the war into the 60s as you could?
There was no external motivation. It's that I actually grew up with gangsters as well as many other things. My father.
This is really quite drawn upon your personal life.
It really is. And I tell you something. I know the gangsters of the period. I knew them. And they were not the way they were depicted in movies. They were much more like just normal people. I mean, they seemed like normal people. They passed as normal people. And I went to school with their children. My parents knew them. My father actually dealt with them in business.
Your descriptions of the war in Europe are harrowing, and you describe scenes from the Normandy invasion, the Allied invasion of Sicily, and you've written about World War I in a previous book. What is it about those wars that you find so compelling?
They were in the Revolution, American Revolution, when we were practically at the end, when Washington had been driven out of New York through New Jersey, this army, he had 10% of his army left, and it looked like everything was finished. Thomas Paine wrote a wonderful pamphlet, and it began with the words, "These are the times that try men's souls," and it rallied everybody. Well, what could try men's souls more than the two greatest wars in history, World War I and World War II?
And now the wars we have today are just trying.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what they're trying to do, I came out of the Second World War. I was born right after the Second World War. Everyone that I knew, everyone's father had been in the war. The war was everything. I lived with French people who had been in the resistance. The man had been a poilu in the First World War. For 4 years, I lived with them, and everything was la guerre, la guerre, la guerre. It is impressed upon me, and even upon my wife, who's 4 years younger, it's the beginning of everything and the emotional root of everything for us.
You have said that you belong to no literary school, but every writer comes out of other writers. Were you thinking of Gatsby's Daisy Buchanan when you created the character of Catherine?
A little bit, yes, I confess, because what I have been haunted by in The Great Gatsby was the light flashing across the bay, that light blinking. That I find so powerful and so haunting, and I thought, and actually you're right. That was one of the things that I had in mind when I wrote this as homage.
Well, it's not bad to pay homage to F. Scott Fitzgerald.
No.
Pretty great. You're well known as a conservative political commentator. You wrote speeches for Bob Dole. You were a contributing editor at the Wall Street Journal. You're a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel odd to be talking about a work of fiction today, just a month before Election Day?
Yeah, and it's not a great position to be in, especially since I'm going to Chicago the day before the election, which is, you know, Barack Obama's hometown, and there I am going to be up on stage. But I'm used to that.
Well, is it comfortable for you to switch back and forth between fiction and nonfiction?
And politics? No. In fact,
because this is not a political novel.
No, not at all. And it would be a really big mistake to take it as such. None of my fiction is political. However, it is somewhat like a Hasidic Jew showing up, running around the Kaaba in Mecca, in terms of the modern conventions of the novel. Because it is not ironic. It's not pessimistic. It's not dark. It's not black. It's not limited to one particular topic. It's very old-fashioned in that way, the way the novel used to be.
How do you feel about the film that's being made based on Winter's Tale, directed by Akiva Goldsman? Are you involved in the production?
Totally not. You sell them the rights, and that's it. Then
I hope you got more than $5,000, $100 down and $5,000 after this contract was signed.
I did.
And you have Colin Farrell as your protagonist. That's not bad.
That's not bad. And the thing about Akiva is that he did A Beautiful Mind, which I thought was very well done. And he also did Cinderella Man, which I thought was really terrific. And I can watch Russell Crowe, you know, day and night. So I'll just hope for the best.
Well, your father was a protege of Samuel Goldwyn's, wasn't he?
He was Samuel Goldwyn's protege for a while. He started working for Charlie Chaplin in 1912. And then he was in on the founding of United Artists, where he was the director of publicity. Then he became president of London Films. He made films such as The Third Man, Richard III, The Tales of Hoffman, The Red Shoes. That was also part and parcel of British intelligence.
Michael Powell was one of my favorite directors.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never met him, but I met a lot of these other people. I grew up with them, you know, Larry Olivier.
Sir Larry. Esquire has called you the last epic novelist. Do you think that's true?
I don't know who else
is
out there.
Tom Wolfe may be working on an epic novel.
Yeah, he writes that. But his work is more closely focused, and it's more modern. And it is more closely focused. There's no question about it.
And another reviewer said you're an affirmer. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, life is short. Well, what do you have to go around complaining for?
Well, in this case, you have a lot of complicated things happening. People could complain. But in the end, did you know when you started how this whole thing was going to turn out?
Nope, I did not. And usually I do, because usually I have the last line in mind and I work to it. And it serves as an organizing principle, but not here. This one, it just sort of happened.
Well, you say everything boils down to love of God.
I say that in the book?
No, but haven't you said it elsewhere?
I might have. I think it does.
A love of a woman and a child.
Yeah, well, that I do believe.
This novel, In Sunlight and in Shadow, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. My great thanks to Mark Halperin for being on our show again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, really.